antennas out of them by stringing them along a rod, a Yagi-like antenna. So there's a number of places where your eye will fool you. You look down the boom of a Yagi, what you see is a hell of a lot smaller in physical area than the radio area when it's properly tuned. And when you make the directors out of discs, common sense would lead you to believe they're going to act like shadows. They do not. And that becomes a non-polarized antenna. Depending on what you use as the driven element, those discs will give you any polarization you like. It's a beautiful method of making a circular polarized Yagi. K2KE1, K2RIW. I wonder how many of those things you've heard before, Mel.
KC2QIQ with a question.
Okay, go ahead, Glenn, first.
Yesterday we were talking a little bit about, you know, stacked arrays, and one question I've had right now is, because you strike some interest with me with phasing, you know, it's normally, if you have two vertically stacked, on a T-boom, two Yagis, and you start phase shifting them between the two Yagis, you can change the polarization. I was wondering, if you're starting off at 0 degrees, so that both Yagis are in phase, is there an equation for the amount of phase shift or phase delay into the other antenna to polarity, to polarization? Is there some equation that's simple, or is it a little bit more complicated than that?
Okay, to bring people up to speed, what I think Glenn is talking about is one of the configurations we talked about is if you want to horizontally stack Yagis, you've got your mast coming out of the tower, which is connected to a rotator. You've got a T-bar, a horizontal bar parallel to the ground, connected to that mast. On the left-hand side, you could put a vertically polarized Yagi. On the right-hand side, you could put a vertically polarized Yagi. And that's a beautiful side-by-side mount, interferometer, rotatable pair of Yagis. Well, Glenn then said, what would happen if I rotate them horizontally? And when you do, the nearby directors to that T-bar are going to see a lot of extra capacitance. They're going to be detuned. And if you're smart enough, you can retune those directors. The next embodiment we talked about is taking the Yagi on the right-hand side and making it a cross-polarized Yagi. It's got some horizontal elements and some vertical elements. The same number of horizontal elements, the same number of vertical elements, and a horizontal-driven element, a driven dipole, and a vertical-driven dipole. But then the next embodiment is to take that whole cross-polarized Yagi, rotate it 45 degrees. One set of elements is now tilted 45 degrees to the right. One set of elements is tilted 45 degrees to the left. None of the elements are directly parallel with the T-bar. Therefore, the interference of the T-bar has been drastically decreased. Now what Glenn is asking is that when I've got that slant right and slant left set of elements, and I've got two separate feed lines, how do I feed it? Let me drop some. If I feed the two of them in phase, I will add the two signals together from the slant right and the slant left. Assume now that the driven element on the slant right goes down to the 730 position. The driven element on the slant left is fed at the 430 position. So both of them are fed at the down position. I feed them in phase. The slant right and slant left will combine in phase, equal power. I will be transmitting pure vertical polarization. Hard to believe, but it's true. It'll look like there's a slant right signal and a slant left signal in the vicinity of the Yagis. But when that signal gets out into space and it all puts itself back together, it'll be a pure vertical. Reverse the phase of one of those, and now you'll be transmitting pure horizontal. Everything in between, you can change the amplitude, you change the phases, and you can generate circular, elliptical, and whatever. As far as polarization is concerned, the situation is extremely similar to feeding a sine wave to the horizontal plates of your oscilloscope, a sine wave to the vertical plates of your oscilloscope, make them both the exact same frequency, and you're drawing a bunch of ellipses like a subset of the Lissajous patterns. Make the horizontal plates and the vertical plates in phase, and you generate a slant 45 degree angle across the scope. Make them out of phase, and you make a slant 45 degree angle to the left of center. feed nothing but the vertical plates, and you make a vertical line. Feed nothing but the horizontal plates, you make a horizontal line. Feed equal amplitude to the horizontal plates and the vertical plates with 90 degrees out of phase between the two signals, and you'll draw a perfect circle on the scope. Depending on which one leads and which one lags, the circle you draw on the scope will either be rotating clockwise or counterclockwise. The way you put those signals into the horizontal and vertical plates of an oscilloscope, and the way that you draw signals onto that phosphor, is almost identical to the way you create all of the polarizations of these cross-polarized Yagis. When you're using equal amplitude, horizontal and vertical, and 90-degree
repeater, timeout.
Equal amplitude, horizontal and vertical, and you're feeding them 90 degrees out of phase, and you're making a clockwise signal on the oscilloscope, that exact same signal fed to those two Yagis will make a clockwise, circular, polarized wave in space. So all the equations that you've ever used, by the way, it's pretty easy to set up a set of equations where this voltage waveform, call it V1, is going to the vertical plate, and V2 goes to the horizontal plate. V1 is a sine wave, V2 is a sine wave, and I adjust the phases and or amplitudes, I can draw everything I want across that scope. I can fill up that scope any way you want to. And by the exact same token, with the exact same mathematics, I can draw all of those possible polarization states with those Yagis in space. I wonder if that's beginning to make a little more sense, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yes, it did. I came armed with a little bit of study on this one, and you're verifying what kind of like what I was looking at. Now, the next thing is this. When you do 180 degrees mechanically, and you're going to mount this on a boom, I'm assuming from everything that we've said so far that initially, I'm going to call out a mechanical direction for the antenna. So I'm going to say that, okay, both Yagis started off with the gamma matches pointing down when they were vertical. Now that I'm pitching them out to 45 degrees on either side, I'm pitching the tops of the antennas in so that the gamma matches are pointing their way out. Now, if I wanted to flip the feeding phase of that antenna by 180 degrees, would it be safe to assume that if I flipped that Yagi upside down so that even though they're both tilted in towards the top, I have one gamma match pointing up? Will that give me that 180 degree phase shift I'm looking for? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yes, but that's an easy way of doing it, Glenn. You're a smart enough guy that you would like to do all of that switching electronically in the shack. You've got the two separate feed lines coming down, and you've got a switching network in the shack where you can decide to put a 45 degree extra length of cable on one of them, and that creates 90 degrees of delay, quarter wavelength of cable with velocity factor, or 180 degrees of cable, a half wavelength of cable, makes a phase reversal. You don't have to physically move them. But when you set them up slanted 45 degrees right and left, you could say one gamma match rod is going down to the 430 position. The other gamma match rod is going down to the 730 position. Feed 430 and 730 in phase, you're making pure vertical polarization. Feed 430 and 730 out of phase, you're making pure horizontal polarization. Feed them 90 degrees different, you're making clockwise and counterclockwise, depending on which one leads and lags. All of that switching is a relatively simple network of coaxial relays and pieces of cable in the shack. And all of that switching network only has to be on one of the cables going up to the two Yagis. Leave the other one as a reference. As long as you're always going to be feeding equal amplitude, which is the major way you really want to use them, you're going to feed equal amplitude into both Yagis, then only one of them needs a switching network. And now you have all the possible phase shifting in the shack. And now you can, in milliseconds, switch from state A to state B and flip back and forth and find out which way gives you the greatest reception of that signal from an Oscar satellite or that signal is coming to you from over the horizon. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing. That was one of the ideas that I thought of, was taking an antenna switching network and with a couple of lengths of cable, because at 2 meters and at 70 centimeters, the lengths, you know, for the different arrays, I can do it on one side and switch them. But my only concern there was that I tend to use them over a I'm trying to get as much bandwidth as I can, and I'm just trying to figure out is maybe that's not the bandwidth of the antenna is probably going to be wider than fixed cut lengths of individual coax. And then I thought of using an active network, and it's kind of lossy to do it that way. But do you think that over the bandwidth of these antennas, it's going to be a small price to pay just by cutting maybe the center frequency to length and just switching it that way, as opposed to just, you know, mechanically going for, you know, 180 degree? Because most of the time when I'm DXing on VHF and UHF, I like the horizontal polarity. That's usually where I want the big gain. And I'm thinking that it might be interesting to stack two with that slant polarization and then just flip one of the Aggies up on the other side, and I'd probably get the lowest loss. But there again, you know, going back to the switching network, do you think I'd still have some fairly decent bandwidth doing it that way by cutting, you know, the lengths and then having the switching network? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay. The two-meter band starts at 144 and goes to 48 megs. 148 megs, 144 to 148. 4 megacycles wide out of 144 is 2.77% bandwidth. If you chose the right length of cable to be 90 degrees of delay, and you designed it for 144, and you used it at 148, where it's 2.77% longer, 90 degrees becomes 92.5 degrees. That is an extremely minor error. And that's if you were dumb enough to tune the whole thing at 144 and use it at 148. You're a smarter guy, but choose the middle of the band, 146, and go down and up from there, and you'll only have 1.25 degrees of error out of 90. That's nothing. And you could, if you want to be a purist, put a variable capacitor in there that you flip in that gives you another 2 degrees of advance or delay. Very simple. You've got a working system. Stop worrying about the extremely fine details. Back to you, Glenn.
Okay, because I've never done, you know, these multiple arrays before, so I like talking to the expert. It's a little bit of reassurance, so to speak, before I actually start mounting stuff there up on the tower. Now, the next question is this. Okay, now let's say I have a pair of 2 meters on the outside slanted at 45, and then I take a pair of the 70-centimeter antennas, and I slip them in between. Do you think I'll have, and basically the same configuration, another set of switches, because I'm using a different set of feed line coming down for the 70-centimeter antennas. Do you think I could put them all on the same T-boom? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
A guy named John Fandle in Levittown in roughly 1980 did that, and it worked like a charm. No sweat. So the 432 Yagis get mounted a little bit closer to the mast on the T-boom. The 2 meter Yagis are out at the tips. And if you want to, you could extend the T-boom and put another set of the 432 Yagis out a little bit further. Make it a four wide if you want to. And have a switching network where you decide how many of them you're going to feed. As you know, when I had that array of 16 Yagis on the top of the tower, I could decide that by flipping the switches in the shack and the relays that were built into the phasing harness, whether I fed all 16 Yagis, that gave me maximum gain, 5.5 degree beamwidth, horizontally and vertical, or I could switch one single Yagi at the top of the array, that gave me 24 by 24 degrees of beamwidth, or the third position, the middle position really, was one vertical stack, where it was 5.5 degrees in elevation and 24 degrees in azimuth. So each one of those switch positions changed the gain by 6 dB. So I could find the guy in the broad mode and then zoom in on him. And the first step, he came up 6 dB. The second step, he came up another 6 or 12 dB. So in the broad mode, I would switch the antenna in azimuth and find the guy during a contest. Then I would zoom in on him, and he became 12 decibels stronger, and everybody else got a hell of a lot weaker. And I knew I was aimed right at him. Using that antenna, using nothing but 432, and ignoring the 6-meter band, the 2-meter band, the 220, the 1296, ignoring all of the bands, using nothing but 432 and that zoom-switched antenna. On two occasions, I won the VHF contest in the New York, New Jersey area, in the in the K2 area by using just that one band. KCQQIQ, KQLIW.
That's very good, Dick. I think you've given me a late summer antenna project. I've got a nice piece of boom that I can mount horizontally to my mast on top of the rotor, and then get a second set of Yagis for 70 centimeter and 2 meters. And I think I'm gonna try this and give it a shot, because I think this would be a very, very nice way of going between the horizontal to vertical, and at the same time be able to pick up quite a bit of extra gain on an array that should mount a little bit simpler than what I have up there now. Thanks again to K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
As they say in other circles, Glenn, we're going to talk. Okay. It turns out that electronic switching of polarization, horizontal, vertical, clockwise, counterclockwise, slant right, slant left, phased arrays, electronic steering, these techniques have been used by some commercial systems and a whole bunch of military systems for decades. For the most part, amateurs have made very little use of it. Not because they don't have the resources. I think the major difference is that no one explained it to them. There are very few articles on the subject. There are essentially no books on the subject written in English without, some really hairy mathematics. If you understand the lizardry patterns you can draw on an oscilloscope, you're 90% of the way downrange to understanding what all the polarization states are for a radio wave. There's a strong correlation between the two. And switching signals with relays that are out on the antenna, built into the phasing harness, or in the shack with you, if they're not weatherproof relays, that's your choice. Switch wherever you like. But switching phases and amplitudes, it's very easy. And it's something we shouldn't be ignoring. And electronic steering of the antenna. Once you've got antennas to the right of your mast and the left of your mast, and you can shift the phase of the right-hand set versus the left-hand set, you can now do electronic steering even before you do rotation with the rotator. The rotator takes 60 seconds to go 360 degrees. Electronic steering you can do in microseconds if you did it with FET switches, milliseconds if you do it with electromechanical relays. And by flipping back and forth a small amount or a lot amount, you can really do a lot of electronic steering or dither it a little bit to find out whether or not you're foresighted on the guy, whether or not you want to steer him into a null. You can have a lot of fun with phased array techniques. They're not that complicated. It's just a matter of if you can add ordinary scalar numbers together to add the vector numbers, which represent phase shift, is not too much more difficult. The average electronic engineer, and amateur in particular, hears the word phase shift and his eyes glass over. It isn't because he doesn't want to understand phase shift. It isn't because it's that magic. It's because the way it was introduced to him, in my mind, was improper. The females in my house are all math hostile. They don't really hate math. They hate the way they were introduced to the subject. The majority of amateurs hate phase shift. They hate try to understand phase shift. They don't really hate it. It's a powerful tool. They can only dislike the way they were introduced to it. Talk about it among ourselves, and all of a sudden the mystique will go away. It won't be that magic. You'll understand it. Thank you, Glenn, for any comments on all of the above. KQRIW.
KC2FYJ comments.
Yeah, Dick, the other station identified. Just one quick more question on this one. If I were to use here, because I like to keep everything in a 50-ohm system, and I'm using already, commercially available Cushcraft antennas. I'm pretty sure I've mentioned them to you before. And, I spent quite a number of years over in MPD making dividers. And the dividers give me 90-degree separation. So is it okay to use the 90-degree, know which way I'm going from 0 and 90 degrees across my 0-degree port, my 90-degree port? This way I keep everything in 50 ohms. And then just basically, no, that's not what I want to do either. Yeah, actually it is. In other words, this way, when I come back into a single cable here in the shack, I can have my combiner splitting the two, keeping both cables at 50 ohms, and then basically just add the length to one side to bring me back to zero, or subtract more, if you follow what I'm saying, to give me, in other words, I can use the 90 degrees of the combiner to add and subtract from, to give me my phase difference and multiple phases and shift things around, if you follow what I'm saying, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Harry, recognize? We'll get to you in a second, Harry. Assuming you got one transmitter and you want to feed two antennas equal power, you do require a power divider. The power divider could be a 3 dB directional coupler. It can be a 3 dB branch coupler. It can be a Wilkinson hybrid. The Wilkinson hybrid divides the power equally, and they both come out in phase. The 3 dB quadrature hybrid, 3 dB directional coupler, same thing, gives you equal power of two signals, but the 90 degrees out of phase. So you could flip from one kind of a power divider to the other kind of power divider when you want to change the phases. That's one approach. The other approach is you choose a Wilkinson hybrid, or the dumb equivalent that we amateurs often use, a quarter wave matching transformer that matches one signal in and two signals out, everything 50 ohms. And that's the way to feed everything in phase. And when you want to feed them 90 degrees delayed or 180 degrees delayed, you flip in another length of cable on one of those lines coming out of the Wilkinson hybrid. You've got a problem, Glenn. You've got five different ways to do it, at least. It's going to be hard for you to choose the easiest way with the hardware that's available to you. You've got too many choices. And if you're smart enough, every one of them will work. Back to you, Glenn.
Yeah, very good, Dick. As that was basically the question, because I can use those. I can use the 90. I can use the do them in phase, and then I can switch them around. Yep, absolutely. Very good. So I'm glad to hear that. Why don't you pick up the other breaking station? I think they had a couple of comments in there, but thanks again to K2RIW, KC2QAQ, and hopefully we can discuss this a little bit further more before I actually start putting some aluminum up on the roof there, if you know what I mean. KC2QIQ.
Hey, Glenn, we're going to talk, and it's going to cost you. You're getting a free consulting service. I'm only half kidding on that one. Don't worry about the money. Harry doesn't have a whole lot of comments. He's just got one beautiful one. One great big one. KC2FYJ, K2RIW.
Just a couple of points. Number one, this is a topic that seems to keep coming back up every now and then on TechNet, because I was talking with you about the same thing, a year and a half, 2 years ago, with phase-shifting feeding of dipoles in order to get a rotatable, electronically rotatable dipole. And the other comment that I wanted to make is that, as you indicated, the military's been doing this for years. I used to work at Sperry a bazillion years ago when it was still around in Lake Success, and they were using phase-shifted arrays to do no-moving-part radar antennas. And so that's a technology that's been around in the military for a long time.
It sure has. And in the early days of the transistorized amplifiers, the hybrids, the switching networks, whatever, by modern day standards, they were kind of crude, kind of expensive, hard to come by, and whatever. Nowadays, when Harry, Dick, and Glenn go to a good flea market, 80% of these parts we'll get on the second and third flea market we go to. We'll pay, 5 cents on the dollar for getting the hardware. If you buy it outright for people of our resources these days, it's not going to break the bank. Many of these things can be homebrewed. The guys that are working way up at 145 gigahertz in the Boston area, and I know some of them, W1RIL and W1GHZ, because some of the hardware that they need at these exotic frequencies are expensive as all hell, W1RIL just goes to his lathe and builds it. And he asks his fellow microwave buddies that are part of the Northeast Weak Signal Society, hey, should I build three of them at once? Do you want one also? So amateurs are crafty people. There's lots of ways of doing it. So we shouldn't be afraid of electronic switching of angles, azimuth or elevation, polarization, frequencies, whatever. It isn't rocket science. If you're willing to take the first few steps and and realize there's ways of understanding it that doesn't have to make it so complicated. It doesn't require the understanding of three-dimensional vector equations and Fourier transforms. The books would lead you to believe it does. It doesn't. It isn't rocket science. If you understand one or two steps of how an interferometer works, by interferometer, let me drop. Assume I've got a left-hand antenna and a right-hand antenna on the T-bar, and I got two separate feed lines coming down. And the whole antenna array is aimed dead north, and the signal coming to me from dead north. I'm getting equal amplitude and equal phase of the signals out of the left-hand antenna and the right-hand antenna. Okay, the guy that's dead north of me keeps transmitting. But for some reason, I start rotating the antenna 10 degrees to the right. The whole T-bar rotates 10 degrees to the right. When I do that, the left-hand antenna moves further north by a cosine function, or is it a sine function? The right-hand antenna moves further south by a sine function of the 10 degrees that I've rotated. I can figure out exactly how many inches and feet the left-hand antenna has moved forward and the right-hand antenna has moved back. Since the left-hand antenna has moved closer to that source of signal to the north, I know exactly how much sooner in nanoseconds or degrees in phase that signal arrives earlier at the left-hand antenna. And the signal arrives later at the right-hand antenna by the exact same mathematics. Step by step, it ain't that complicated. It's a diagram you can draw on a page, and even if you're uncomfortable with the mathematics, you can make a scale model out of paper and steer it 10 degrees with your protractor and compass, if you know what I mean, and make a measurement with a ruler if you don't want to use sines and cosines and tangents. So one way or another, you can find out how much one is advancing, how much the other is retarding. When you do that, and you put those two signals into a combiner, because they're slightly out of phase, one's leading and one's lagging, it's equivalent to having two big hands on the clock. One big hand on the clock has moved from 12 o'clock over toward 1:30. The other big hand on the clock, the other vector, signal strength, has moved from 12 o'clock toward 10:30. And the way they combined is a fairly simple piece of mathematics. So when you rotate the whole array far enough so that the right-hand signal is a hand on the clock as a vector that moves to 3 o'clock, and the left-hand antenna moves to the left to 9 o'clock, and I add those two vectors together, 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock, they're exactly opposed to each other, they add to 0. You have just...
Repeater, time out.
You have just calculated where the first null in the composite antenna pattern will be for that particular interferometer. There are relatively simple polar diagrams you can draw that tells you exactly what's going to happen. You have the option, if you want to realize that now the two signals, one went 90 degrees to the right on my polar diagram, one went 90 degrees to the left, advanced 90 and retarded 90, I can put an extra length of cable in there, 180 degrees of cable, and bring them back in phase. I can electronically steer the signal back to dead north, even though mechanically I have steered it 10, 15 degrees to the right. Assuming my Yagi's got enough beamwidth to cover that, I can now electronically steer and compensate for what happened with the mechanical steering. Just to give you a crazy example, the wind is blowing the array and it's waving back and forth. If I'm smart enough, I can be electronically shifting everything in the shack and keeping the radiated signal still aimed on the target. Or I can sweep that beam across space as fast as I can sweep the phase. And if I'm doing it with the right kind of electronics, I can do that in nanoseconds or microseconds. You see the power of that? I can steer that beam electronically in azimuth. If I'm smart enough in the way I set it up, I can steer it in elevation. I can do it fast, slow. I can compensate for mechanical things. I can shift the polarization. If I'm looking at satellites with this thing, boy, I can have a grand old time. I think you're slowly seeing the power of that. By way of your exposure at Ferry, you've seen it. And this is not rocket science. I guarantee you can do it in your backyard, Harry. KC2FYJ, K2LIW. Then pass it over to Glenn.
Yeah, the trick is just building the right electronics. And then once you've figured that out, the rest is falling off a lock. I'm going to sit back on the side now. I'll turn it over to Glenn. This is KC2FYJ.
The guys in Mineola are smart enough to do that, Harry. You got it, Glenn. Even the guys in Massapequa, they know how to do it.
I don't know about the guys at Massapequa here, but all I can say is it's going to probably take me a couple of shots before I get it right. But it's a lot of fun trying, and I'll tell you, putting it up, definitely want to give this a shot, because, you know, I find that, you know, the most useful polarization for me on, you know, on 2 meters and 70 centimeter DXing is definitely horizontal polarization, but it would be nice to use that same array for, you know, if I can get the whole bandwidth out of the beams so I can use them, you know, because I have balanced coupling, and I get a really, really nice match, you know, really across the whole band. So if I could get them to, so I could steer them now and work across the whole band, that's an awesome thing. Definitely something I want to give a try, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QAQ.
And you're afraid that maybe it's not going to work at first. Who cares? It's not going to explode. It's not going to catch on fire. It just gives you a response that's different, and you troubleshoot it and find out why, and you get smarter. But there is no real failure. That's the beauty of building a project like this that's not costing you, you know, it's not using up 50% of the family resources. It's going to use up an hour of your pay to buy the raw resources to do it. And if it doesn't work at first, it'll work on the second or third time, a chance. You'll find the right person to ask questions to. You'll say, hey, I did this, this, and this. I expected to get that, and I got this instead. Either by figuring it out yourself, talking to people, you make the changes. There is no failure in this thing. It's an educational process. It's fun. That particular antenna array with that zoom control was essentially the most fun thing I've ever done in ham radio. I used that from, I think it was 1980 to 1985. I think that's when Hurricane Gloria took that antenna off the tower for me. Removed every piece of that metal in one swell swoop. And I didn't cry over it, because the calculated wind failure of this very light array, this 3,500 cubic feet of antenna, 15 feet wide, 15 feet high, 13 feet deep, all built at the 100-foot level of a Roan number 6 tower. It had a calculated wind failure of 78 miles an hour. Hurricane Gloria probably hit the top of my tower at 105. It was supposed to fail. It did what it was supposed to do. It got yanked off the tower, and all of that aluminum got deposited in my front lawn. I didn't cry. It's time to build the next antenna. Hurricane Gloria was a once-per-50-year event. So it wasn't that I had this black cloud over me, if you know what I mean. Anybody have any further questions or comments on all of the above, give me your call letters right now, K2RIW.
KC2QIQ.
You got it, Glenn.
KC2YO.
YO next. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, hi, Bernie. Let me just, one of the things, I guess, you know, while you're talking about this, brings back a lot of memories to microwave power devices days, and we were doing a lot of phase-shifted array radar for, we were doing the PA books for Grumman, and at that time they were interested in having an aircraft wing with multiple elements, you know, placed inside. And I guess one of the things that always kind of scared me about doing these kinds of phased arrays was that they were always so worried about how low the side lobes were, you know, because the accuracy of that radar was dependent on the structure of the antenna and, you know, keeping those side lobes as low as they possibly could to get the narrow beam widths. But I guess, like what you're saying here, really for, like, sideband and, you know, sideband VHF and UHF, it's probably not as critical, especially only with, you know, two Yagi devices as opposed to the multiple, like, you know, 32 elements that were being used in radar, and I don't need side lobes anywhere near as critical, you know, so it's the performance here should probably be a lot easier to obtain. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, good point that you brought up. In the case of an airborne radar, the amplitude of the side lobes can give you azimuthal ambiguity. The amplitude of the vertical side lobes gives you a whole lot of ground clutter. So a radar on an airplane is an extremely severe requirement for side lobes of the antenna, radome, and the combination in the airframe. That whole installed antenna performance is very critical for the radar to do its job. It is such that I have often said an airborne radar is an extremely carefully designed, extremely carefully implemented, installed antenna on the airplane that you then hang some electronics on it, and you call it a radar. If you ain't got the antenna, you haven't got an airborne radar. As simple as those words are, I can point to you to a major organization that built an extremely expensive system and did it the other way around. They spent all of their money and resources making the best electronics in the world, and then they threw on any old antenna in a ratty place on an airplane with a yucky radar. And they spent the next 4 years, step by step, attempting to fix it. And a tremendous amount of money and reputation and whatever went down the tubes. They had it backwards. Airborne radar, very tough environment. When it comes to we amateurs, if the side lobe is 15 dB too strong, big deal. And the side lobe in general is not robbing power from the main lobe. Strong misconception. The strong side lobe is giving you an ambiguity. You've aimed it dead north, and you got a side lobe that's aimed toward, dead north toward Albany, and you got a side lobe to the northeast aimed toward Buffalo, Boston. Big deal. You hear some QRM from the guy in Boston during the contest while you aim at the guy in Albany. That's not a showstopper. It's an annoyance. And with your electronic steering, you move the antenna a little bit so the first null in the side lobe between the second and first side lobe falls on Boston. That nulls him out, while the main lobe goes a little bit to the east of Albany, and the guy you're listening to Albany is 2 dB weaker. And the guy in Boston...
Repeater, time out.
And the guy in Boston just got 20 dB weaker because you went into the notch. Our requirements are nowhere near that severe. There is no failure. And even though you're going to get some glitches, the thing is going to be not as ideal as you like. There's ways you can then add electronic engineering change notes. You can add ECMs to the system to repair, to whittle away the picadillos one at a time, if that's what you want to do. It can become a project that will keep you off the streets for a long time to come, Glenn. I see what Bernie's going to say. KC2, Yankee Oscar, K2LIW.
Good evening, Dick, Glenn, Lynette, everybody. I just had a question that just brought up. We're talking about vertical and horizontally polarized arrays. In the 2-meter range, if I am the wrong polarization, for example, if I try to hit the one of the feet are horizontally polarized, how much loss in dB am I really suffering for doing that?
Yeah, there's an easy and there's a complicated answer to that one, Bernie. You may think your horizontally polarized Yagi is purely horizontal. You do a careful measurement on it, and you'll find out there's some vertical signal coming out of that antenna that's 15, 20, 25 dB down. No antenna is pure. To some degree, every single antenna is elliptical. The ratio between the horizontal and vertical may be 25 dB, which makes it elliptical. Very few things are pure. And the most pure circular polarization antenna you make is still going to have an axial ratio of a dB or two. Nothing is perfect. And even if the antenna is perfect, the environment is chirality. Chirality is the term the RF people use. It's also a term used in biology, by the way. It's a term used by the fact that the environment will do funny things to polarization. That signal that starts off purely horizontal from your hometown and bounces off that water tower 2 miles away from me, and a portion of that signal gets to me, ends up in my backyard with a slightly different polarization. That water tower has got a complex shape to it. A purely horizontal signal doing a billiard shot off that water tower is going to arrive at a slant 45 degree polarization in my backyard. That's an example, a simple example, of the chirality of the environment. Here's the next example. 10 years ago, I was traveling every single weekend up to the Romare Development Center near Utica, New York. In my automobile, I had a horizontally polarized square loop antenna, an M-squared square loop, whatever it's called, and a vertical 5/8 wave whip, and a relay right alongside of the driver's position inside the car, where I could flip rapidly, mechanically, back and forth between the two. And I'm talking to single sideband guys on 2 meters. Let me drop. While I'm making this 4.5 hour drive from New York to Utica each weekend. I went up there each Sunday night, worked from Monday till Friday, came home Friday night, and then next Sunday night repeated the process. Did that for 2 solid years while working on a very fancy project at the Romare Development Center. So on the way, I'm talking to the guys in southern New Jersey, northern New Jersey, New York, whatever, on 2 meter single sideband, occasionally the FM guys. The sideband guys, like there's a guy in southern New Jersey, K2TXB, Russ, who I would talk to from southern New Jersey. He's using a moon-mount array of 2 meter antennas on 2 meters, single sideband. He's talking to me over a 200-mile range while I'm going up the New York Thruway, Loop 87, and then over to Route 90, and all the way over to Utica, New York. And I'm on the north side of that set of mountains. I think it's the Adirondack Mountains. 200 miles away through all those mountains. That signal is being sifted into that automobile, and we're holding a two-way conversation with 90-95% copy throughout most of that trip. When I flip back and forth between the horizontally polarized antenna and the vertically polarized antenna while listening to Russ's K2TXB's pure horizontal signals, there was no difference. He's transmitting horizontal. By the time it sifts through all of those buildings and trees and mountains and everything else and gets to my automobile, horizontal versus vertical sounded the same. When I got to a scenic overlook where I could look for 15 or 20 miles, then the right polarization was 15 dB louder. But when I was down in the valleys of that New York State Thruway, and that signal got to me by a very arduous path, if I knew how that signal got to me, boy, I guarantee I would be surprised as all hell. I was surprised as all hell that I could hold a conversation 200 mile sideband with yucky antennas in an automobile while I'm talking to a moonbound capable station, a guy who's a big gun. He's rating a gallon. I was sending 180 watts to him, and he was getting I was getting 95% copy of him, and he's getting about 90% copy of me. And we're talking about all kinds of things like we are right now. And I was doing that every weekend. It was a fun operation. So the word polarization and cross-polarization has funny meanings depending on what is the environment.
Repeater, timeout.
What is the environment between the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna? How many miles? How much stuff? How pure is the polarization? You may think that repeater is purely vertical, but maybe it's tilted 9 degrees or 5 degrees to the right of vertical from your point of view. You may think your antenna is pure horizontal, but it's got a certain vertical component. And the environment is going to do funny things to that polarization. So as you can see, there's no clear answer. When I told people I was going to, at first, transmit with a vertical 5/8 wave whip from an automobile and talk to horizontally polarized people, they said, "You're wasting your time. Boy, what a goofball." I did it. And then they said, "Well, it's going to be a zillion dB better if you put up a horizontal antenna." I put up a horizontal antenna on the car. It didn't get a zillion dB better. It got no better at all 95% of the time. So the word polarization in the real world, sometimes it's got some funny meanings. I didn't give you an exact answer, but I told you some of the ingredients, Bernie. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2 LIW.
Okay, so to summarize that, could I then say that it's a worst case 15 dB loss, best case no dB loss? Would that be appropriate? The application I'm thinking about is I want to experiment some with horizontal antennas. I live in the shadow of the 850.
Bernie, did you hand it back to me?
I don't know if I'm going to be able to make it. I just lost batteries on that other rig. But the point is that if I'm in the shadow of the 850 machine and point a horizontal antenna at it, I'm assuming I'm going to hit it and light it up. Is that valid?
Yeah, absolutely. Assuming now that you're in the shadow of that repeater and they're giving you a signal that's 80 dB over the noise, and you reject the signal by 15 dB because of cross-polarization, you're never going to see the difference. And by the way, when you're close to a pure source of vertical and you're using a almost pure horizontal, and you sweep that antenna, you're going to find out the antenna pattern for cross-polarization is quite different. It'll have lobes in funny places. Those are called Condon lobes because Mr. Condon first described the phenomenon of cross-polarization antenna patterns in a particular section of number 12 of the Radiation Laboratory books, McGraw-Hill, published right after World War II. So you're going to see the Condon lobes of your particular antenna when you sweep it. But go ahead for it. I mean, just because it's cross-polarization doesn't mean it's going to work. The antenna you're listening to right now is a 14-element Cushcraft Yagi mounted on a 100-foot of tower in my backyard in Huntington. That antenna is not horizontal. It is not vertical. The polarization is rotated 45 degrees. The boom of my antenna was rotated 45 degrees before I tightened it down to the mast. I am halfway between the horizontal people and the vertical people. I'm 3 dB down from each, but I can talk to both. That's the poor man's way of talking to both. The right way to do it is the way Glenn is talking about doing it. K2YO, K2LIW.
KC2QIQ with a demonstration.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Okay, right now, this transmission is vertically polarized, directly pointed at the repeater, with five elements right now, and I'm going to switch over in just a second to a 13-element antenna in horizontal polarization. Give me 1 second. Okay, now I'm pointed at the same direction on the repeater, except now I'm horizontally polarized with 13 elements. KC2QIQ.
You develop an extremely tiny amount of hiss when you went horizontal. And if you had a way of feeding it back to yourself so you could hear it, and you swish the antenna a little bit left and right, even that hiss would go away when you're on the cross-polarization. Back to you, Glenn.
Yeah, I'm back on vertical right now, but that's an idea of, you know, what you can expect from, you know, base to base kind of a configuration where, you know, I'm just switching over from Massapequa to the repeater site, which is kind of interesting because I'm pointed in both directions. There is definitely some attenuation there, but it's going to vary, like you said, from site to site and how much reflection is in between and, you know, of what the signals are actually bouncing off between us. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Good demonstration. You got it, Bernie.
Well, very interesting, guys. That's exactly what I was looking for. Thank you much. K2YO, clear.
When in doubt, try it. And don't be scared just because it's cross-polarized. Doesn't mean it's going to crash and burn. Mel, is there anything we should try to answer? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Quite late. We're just about almost finished here. Say a few final words. You mentioned signs of VHF, UHF, Yagis, work done by K1FO, Steve, and the other fellow was Gunter Hoff, DL6, I believe is DL6WU was his call. And the question again is, you know, about the spacing. For some reason, you know, you can really vary spacing, and it always gives me, you know, some kind of thought that, you know, with all the modeling, the spacing, it seems to always be a stumbling point, even with all this stuff that's been written. Basically, what are we really looking for, you know, in spacing? You know, I remember I read about Gunter Hoff's explanation that what it means. Starts out at one point, and he says they found that what a constant spacing. I think he said, what did he come up with? Like 0.4 wavelength as constant, and is that really good rule of thumb to go across the entire Yagi design with that thick over?
Gunter, if you dig deep enough into his literature, he's got an exact formula, which tells you his definition of a nearly ideal spacing, and you use the raw ingredients of what frequency are you on, which really sets the wavelength, and what do you really believe is the gain of your antenna. As the gain of your antenna gets higher, because it's a longer boom, Yagi, better tuned, whatever, its effective capture area becomes a bigger, slightly elliptical circle in space. The whole reason you stack, let's say, two antennas is you'd like to get twice the effective capture area. You'd like to get 3.01 dB of improvement in gain because you're using two antennas where you used to use one. Proper power dividing, proper phasing, proper spacing. You add the second antenna to the first, you will get close to 3 dB of increase. But there's a catch. A 3 dB of increase occurs at an extremely large spacing compared to the spacing that's popular. And it gives you a slightly homely pattern when the spacing is that wide, in the direction of the spacing. You stack them vertically, you're going to have a slightly vertical, homely pattern. Narrow main lobe, pretty strong side lobe. It's fully operational, but unless you've got the great accuracy in setting the elevation of the antenna, particularly if it's one with a as-L tilting motor for moon bounce, that slightly ugly pattern is going to give you some grief. You tend to move the pattern, the stacking distance for that particular set of Yagis closer together so that the effective capture areas just start overlapping. The circles, or slightly elliptical circles, just start kissing each other. Because of the way circles have an overlapping area that at first is very small, because you've got a curve to the left and a curve to the right on each of the individual circles, and you're starting to bring them together. They're kissing each other. At first, the area of overlap is very small. Therefore, the gain decreased from the overlap caused by too close a spacing at first goes down very slowly. Let me drop. But the pattern improves as you do it. So now, there's a compromise. How pretty a pattern do I want? Or how much gain am I willing to sacrifice of the potential 3 dB? And the average guy settles on 2.5 dB of gain increase. He throws away half a dB of gain, and he gets a pretty pattern. That's a pretty good compromise. No matter what stacking distance you use, you're going to be able to find somebody who says, that's too wide. You're going to find somebody else who says, that's too narrow. The rate at which the pattern changes, the rate at which the gain changes, is fairly slow. There's a pretty big sloppy area in between in which you're darn close to target. But like everything else in life, it's a compromise. Can't have it all. And, for instance, the absolute maximum gain of my Yagis, the 19-element RIW Yagis, would have been 5.7 feet. They're a 5.7-foot diameter effective capture area, each individual antenna. 5.7 would have been the optimum. High gain with very little sacrifice would have been 5.5. 4.5 would be something like 3/4 dB of gain, but a beautiful pattern. I settled for a compromise, 5.0. Or was it 5.25? I think I settled for 5.0. There is no perfect stacking distance. But Gunter has come up with a formula where if you know the gain and the frequency, he'll tell you most likely this is the one you're going to settle on. There are other much more simplistic formulas which say the square root of the boom length, or exactly the boom length, or some constant times the square root of the boom length. Well, that assumes that your particular boom length has some particular quality of tuning. I could have a 13-foot long boom length Yagi that has 15 dB of gain over a dipole because it's well tuned, or I could have a 13-foot long boom length, again on 432, which instead of having 15 dB of gain, has only got 12 dB of gain. Because of the mistuning and only 12 dB of gain, I've got a smaller effective capture area. I could, if I want to, stack those particular antennas closer together before I run into a gain sacrifice due to overlap. So gain is really where it is, not boom length. The boom length is making a leap of faith that your antenna was well-tuned. Well, I'd rather make the leap of faith that I have measured the gain and I know what it really repeated.
Time out.
And once I have measured the gain, by the laws of physics, I know what the area has to be. Therefore, I know what the overlap stacking distance will be. So when in doubt, measure the gain. Unless it's somebody's well-documented design that you've built exactly a Chinese copy, you haven't modified anything, and therefore, by repeatability, you think you know the gain. We've got about 3.5 minutes, Mel. K2KEY.
KC2FYJ with a query.
Go ahead, Harry.
doesn't all of that assume a single fixed frequency, and doesn't it all become a compromise if you want to center it on a band anyway?
I just gave an example of one of the wider VHF bands, 2 meters, 144 to 148, 4 megacycles wide. That's only a 2.7%, 2.77, let me call it 2.8. That's only a 2.8% change from the lowest to the highest frequency on that band. Yes, if you built a Yagi for 144.2 and peaked it up there, and then used the Yagi at 148, that 12 dB gain Yagi is probably going to be down to 10.5 dB of gain. Therefore, you could make a little bit of difference in the stacking distance. But we're talking about the minutiae here, Harry. I will admit that the 50 megacycles wide of the 432 band, and nobody uses it all, would be a little bit more difficult. Now, you're worrying about a relatively minor factor. I will admit that a Yagi tuned at the low end of the band and used at the high end of the band, they tend to have the cliff effect. They fall off pretty fast in gain when you go up in frequency. A smarter guy will tune the Yagi high and use it low because they fall off very slowly when you go down in frequency. But that shift in gain versus frequency for the usual VHF amateur bands is not so bad. And when it comes to the 80 meter band, you're not likely to build much more than the three element Yagi. And its change in gain versus frequency, because the number of elements is so small, it's again a minor factor for a different reason. I don't think you got to worry about this one, Harry. Back to you, Harry.
I was thinking more in terms of 6 and 10 meters.
Oh, you build an antenna for 6 meters, and you think it's going to be the right stacking distance for 10 meters. Well, when it comes to serious
No.
Okay, what are you doing between 6 and 10?
No, I was just thinking in terms of stacked Yagis for 6 or stacked Yagis for 10, where the bandwidth would be more of a factor rather than in the VHF range.
From our earlier discussion, you're going to build some number of Yagis for the 6-meter band, some number of Yagis for the 10-meter band. You're going to put them together in the same bed spring, and they do not see each other during that operation. What's the problem?
No, you're missing it. I'm thinking just for, not a set of stacked 6 and 10 simultaneously. I'm talking about just a set of 6 or just a set for 10. The question is, would the frequency that you design it for, if you design it in the middle, are you going to have significant loss by the time you get to either end? If you design it for the top, will you have significant loss by the time you get to the bottom on 6 or on 10?
I must be missing something. 6 meters has a particular wavelength. You're going to be stacking it some number of wavelengths. 10 meters has a certain wavelength. For that particular gain, you're going to stack it some number of wavelengths. I'm missing what the problem is.
I'm talking or referring to that loss of gain because of the overlap.
That loss of gain is strictly the percentage of overlap of circles whose diameter you know about because you can calculate it. I don't think there's a problem, Harry.
So because we're talking percentage, it's probably going to be pretty much the same that you would see on any of the frequencies. Or am I confused?
You use the same percentage of overlap for that particular frequency, you're going to get the same percentage of gain detriment. It's almost a science. Say goodbye, Mill. You got about 15 seconds. Bye-bye, you guys.
I'm just going to say goodnight. This is K2KEY. I have a lot more questions and comments about all of the above, but we'll have to let it go. This is
Repeater.
Okay, I just switched over to the eastern input. And so, antennas are an extremely good subject to discuss. Looks like we've opened up a beauty. So we'll be discussing this for the next few tech nets. Is that okay, Mel? An icon to you? Yes, definitely. And we'll be discussing it. There's more to follow. The big thing you and I got to worry about, Mel, we got to stay healthy so we can keep discussing these things. Bye-bye for now.
Take care. upgrade I switched over.
Bye-bye, Mel. See you down the log. And we'll pick up those antennas next week. Look what Andy started.